medical court may or may not accept. That's all. It's just a credible source of information.
So me as a sovereign and my court and my suit, am I a credible source to issue a letter of victory?
In theory you are, but you don't have to do that. And the reason is because you're not foreign to the system. In fact, quite the opposite. You own the system. You know? You're one of the people. The sovereignty of the government is in the people. The government has no sovereignty. Okay? All they have is authority that has been granted to them by the sovereign people. And they have to stay within that. And if there's no specific grant of authority, they can't do it. Now, I realize, I should say they may not do it. They're doing a lot of things today that are absolutely unconstitutional. Okay? I suspect Social Security is unconstitutional. Because I think they've justified Social Security on the health and welfare clause of the preamble. But I don't think that, well, I know that the preamble is just general concepts and does not provide specific authority to them on that level, okay? So, in fact, there's been cases where people have tried to sue the government because the government failed to protect them. And the courts have said that there is nothing in the Constitution that obligates the government to protect a specific person, even if that person's life is in danger. The only authority the government has is a general authority to protect the group, but they can't protect the individuals. And that's a good decision, because if they're authorized to protect the individual, what stops them from saying, we're putting you in jail because we think you're in danger? Right? So you want the power of decision to lie with the individual, not with the government. So, anyhow, let's see, law notes. Back to procedure. So anyway, we have... all right, the elements of the... I think I got the right one. Let's see that. Yeah. Okay. So, here's the general structure of how a lawsuit's put together. Now, we'll get into the actual way you put things on paper. But, basically, when you're talking common law, it all starts with a declaration. Okay? Now, in our paperwork, we'll probably call it an action, or the equity equivalent of an action is a complaint. Okay? Now remember this, that in any paper, although you put certain titles on it, those titles do not control. What controls is what you actually say in the body. Now, when we filed a case one time, I went up to the window and I had a counterclaim complete with who the original plaintiff and defendant was and who the counter plaintiff and who the counter defendant was. It was all laid out in proper form. But the clerk was ignorant, deputy clerk. And I didn't want to fight the battle and take it up to the big clerk. I just wanted to get the thing filed now. Okay? So the clerk looked at the paper and said, well, this is wrong. He says, you can't do this. And this says counterclaim. It has to say complaint. Okay? I said, okay, well, what is it that's wrong? Let's go through it. So he pointed out these things. So he says, you'll have to fix it and bring it back later. I said, okay. And then right there at the window, by hand, I scratched out, I think it was counterclaim, and I put complaint, just like he wanted. And then I put a big X through the original plaintiff and defendant, you know, the original case, which you'll see what I'm talking about later. But I made these scratch out, made these temporary changes, gave it to the clerk. He says, oh, okay. You can file it now. You see, your paperwork is supposed to be typewritten. Now, if you look up the legal definition of typewritten means hand printing that's legible. Okay? That's why I knew I could do this. And apparently the clerk knew that too. Yeah, it's got to be legible. That's the deal. So, and since I used to be a draftsman, I print very clearly. So anyhow, the body still said counterclaim. The body still named who the counter defendants were. It still named the original case and so on. So when we got a demur from one of the defendants, and this particular attorney complained about the fact that here it says complain up, or it says plaintiff and defendant up here, and down here it's saying counterclaimant and counterdefendant. He says he was all confused. He didn't know what was what. Well, in our reply to his answer, or to his demur, actually, in our reply to his demur, we pointed out to him, well, it's what's in the body that controls. It doesn't matter what the heading says. Okay? Anyhow, so it starts with the declaration. Now, what is a declaration? A declaration is a statement of truth. Okay? And the customary way, now here's where we're going to run into some rough waters here, but at the end of the declaration, you put that it was, you say that I declare under penalty of perjury that the foregoing is true and correct. Okay? Now, remember this. I know that there's religious objections to that. Okay? And as you've heard earlier, there are religious objections to making an oath. Okay? But you have to look at things in context. And the context here, as far as I'm concerned, is 100% secular. Has absolutely nothing to do with the spiritual side of life. Okay? Remember this, that my justification for this is that I have been informed that the Bible says that this is Satan's world until Armageddon comes. And those people who choose to walk with God may do so, but it's still Satan's world. He's in charge. That's what I've been told. Well, I understand. It's all BS, but nevertheless, that's what I've been told. Well, from my standpoint, it's all secular. It's all real world, not spiritual world. Okay? It's the world that I can see, hear, feel, and smell. Okay? And so, when I look at this statement at the end that I declare under penalty of perjury, I know that some people put religious attachments to that, but there's nothing religious about it at all as far as the courts go. What I see is that, are you promising to tell the truth or not? And if they catch you lying, they get to beat you up. Okay, or put you in jail or something. That's all it means to me. And as far as I can see in the operation of the courts, that's all it means. You know, nobody brings a priest in to punish you, unless he happens to be the judge who's wearing a priest's robe, because originally all the judges were priests. But this is a separate branch. This is not the ecclesiastical branch of government. This is the judicial branch of government, which is different from, you know, originally in England you had the basic, under the king, you had basic groupings. You had the military, you had the nobility and their deal, you had the church and their deal. The king of England is also head of the church. Okay? And so ecclesiastical law was totally separate from the secular law, which was separate from the law of the people. Okay, the common law, which is, by the way, Magna Carta. Did somebody here leave me a message about that Confirmatio Cartarum? You did, okay. let's take a little byway on that, because this helps to understand why the common law is good in the courts. The Constitution of the United States has the Seventh Amendment. And the Seventh Amendment says that in all, I think it's cases at law, where the amount in question is over $20, something like that, that the decision of a jury is not reviewable. That Seventh Amendment has been broadly interpreted as meaning the common law, that you're protected, that that's your guarantee that the common law is available to you. But there's other places too. In Article 3 of the Constitution, in the I believe it's the first paragraph, it says something to the effect that the judicial power of the United States is available in all cases in law and equity. Well, law means common law. Okay? So that is the that identifies the fact that the common law is a part of our system. And the Seventh Amendment identifies the fact that the common law is above the statutory law. Why? Because no matter what accusation you bring in, when you're at law, the decision of the jury is not reviewable. Whereas if it's a statutory case where a judge sits there, his decision is reviewable. And in fact, we even have a case which we used in one of our cases where the Supreme Court has said that a decision out of a court of record is not reviewable by them. They are subject to the terms of that decision as well as the rest of the world. Not even they have the authority to override a court of records decision. Yes, sir.
Right here, a comment might be appropriate as far as people's understanding about common law being not applying since 1937 Erie versus Tompkins.
Well, that's true if you start off on the wrong foot. If you start off on the statutory foot instead of the common law foot, that's true. So it all depends on which direction, how you set up your court. You have to set up your court as a common law court. If you set up your court as a statutory court, then the statutes take precedence, and part of the statutes, one of the statutes, I believe it's the Civil Code 22.2, I think it is, that says that the common law shall be the rule of decision so long as it's not repugnant to the statutes. Okay? But that's only if you're in a statute. It's like this. I don't know if you're aware of it, but in California, if there is no law covering the situation, then the laws of Mexico apply. Were you aware of that? And this is because we came from Mexico. Mexico owned this area at one time. And when we got it before we were organized. And so when we brought in our own system of law, we realized we didn't cover everything, so laws of Mexico are going to apply until we get... So in the absence of a statute, you look to Mexican law. So in the absence of a statute, we also look to common law. That's the rule of decision. And I suspect the common law would override the Mexican law. In fact, probably nobody looks at Mexican law anymore because we're so well established now in our own system.
Mm-hmm. Most of those interpretations of common law and then Erie versus Tompkins relate to the Uniform Commercial Code, but that's, of course, statutory.
Yeah, it's all statutory. So, but if you start off in the common law, the Seventh Amendment is the constitutional recognition that the common law supersedes all others. Common law jury has the final say on everything. Okay? Now, what is common law? Well, most of your books tell you that the common law is prior court decisions. Okay? Well, that's part of it. Okay? But if you really want a cast in concrete understanding of what common law is, the first thing you have to understand is that the common law here is the common law of England as it stood in 1776, or maybe 1789. I think it's 1789 when our Constitution took effect. Okay? That's the common law. So now the question comes, well, what was the common law of England at that time? Well, it turns out, you look at the Confirmatio Cartarum, and this was written in the year November 5th, 1297. Yeah, that's right. Common law date, huh? Okay. And we'll enlarge this a little bit. And if you look at number 3 there of the first paragraph, number 3 near the bottom of the first paragraph, it says... And it says that our justices, sheriffs, mayors, and other ministers, which under us have the laws of our land to guide, shall allow said charters pleaded before them in judgment in all their points. That is, to wit, the Great Charter as the common law and the Charter of the Forest for the wealth of our realm. The Great Charter as the common law, well, the Great Charter is Magna Carta. Okay? And the king has said, look, you guys, he's talking to his own staff. He's saying, the Magna Carta is the common law if the defendant demands it. Okay? So you want it in print? Go to the Magna Carta. And the Confirmatio Cartarum makes the link between the United States constitutional recognition of common law and the Magna Carta. So Magna Carta is still good law today. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Back to procedure here. Elements of a common law action. Basically, it starts with the declaration. When you make your declaration, that's your accusation. There are several kinds of actions in common law. And here they are. Basically, in common law, there are 11 common law actions. Now, when you put together your lawsuit, there are certain elements that go on the paper. You got to have the title of the court, the name of the court, like, for instance, the Superior Court of the State of California for in and for the County of Orange. Okay, that would be an example. The venue, that would be in the County of Orange. Okay, and then you select the forum. So, at the commencement of your lawsuit, in other words, the first paragraph, you say who the defendants are and what the forum is. And the forum in this case would be a court of record, as opposed to, let's say, an equity court. Okay? So, once you've identified the forum and the parties, you decree what the law of the case is, because you may recall from prior discussions about sovereignty that the sovereign decrees the law. There is no law until some sovereign decrees it. So you bring your case in, what's the law? Well, you're the sovereign, so you say what the law is. Remember, it's the job of the jury to judge the validity of your law. So I've had trouble enforcing the pink shoe law. But the you decree what the law is. And then after you've done all that, now you get into the actual case. So you have six different kinds of torts, and you have five different kinds of contract issues. Okay? So, in your case, in all likelihood, it's either going to be trespass on the case, or maybe, I'd say special assumption, probably. Those are the most likely ones that I see that you would run into. So, what is trespass? Well, trespass means that you were injured and there was some sort of violence involved. Now, the violence can be implied or it could be actual, either way. A good example of violence is, what if you're arrested? See, that required a violent act. That required physicality. Okay? That would be trespass. Now, don't die on us. We need you. So, there's trespass on the case. Now, trespass involves injury, but no violence. Okay? For example, let's say somebody conned you out of some money. That would be trespass on the case. Somebody set you up on something. It's all fooled you somehow, or violated your rights, but without actually getting physical. The special assumpsit, that's breach of a simple unsealed contract. There's also covenant, but covenant covers a breach of promise under seal. In other words, you have a contract, and you sign the contract, and then you seal it with a seal where you actually crimp the paper. Okay? When you have a contract under seal, or if you put wax on it and then you stamp it the old-fashioned way with a little thing to put your symbol on it, actual seal. when you have a contract like that, that's called a covenant. And But if you don't have the seal, then it's called a simple contract. And yes.
What about trespass on the land?
That same thing as trespass. That's under the that is trespass, not trespass on the case.
Is the sign stronger when you have a sign not to trespass? Does that give you more strength? Or?
Well, yeah, it should, because you know a person could be walking along, he doesn't know where the border of your property is. You know, if you just have open land, you know, if there's some clear indication, you know, if you have a sidewalk leading to your door, a person walks up there, that isn't necessarily trespass. But if you have a gate up and it's locked and somebody jumps over, that may be trespass. Yes.
Is assault a cause for tort?
Yeah, assault is a tort, and it's trespass because it's violence. It involves physicalness, okay? So it's not paper. You know, if I manage...
Verbal assault?
Well, that's a gray area, I guess, verbal assault, but I suspect that's trespass on the case. Because there's no actual physical action, just talk. Just talk. Yes.
I just have a question on the contract with debt. Does the debt have any kind of promissory note or any kind of agreement?
Yeah, debt just means somebody owes you money. The question as to why they owe you money is not part of the picture.
So we don't have to have any kind of proof of the debt?
Well, you sue for debt because the person owes you money. That's it. That's the issue right there. There's no question he owes you the money. The question is enforcement. So you go to the court and you say, hey, I need help in collecting this debt. So the debt's not in question. Of course, the person could answer and say, I never owed you, in which case that changes the character of things. But nevertheless, if it's just a pure debt, I mean, you just go into the court and you ask for a court order and you sue them, you know, sue for debt. On the other hand, if there is a question, then you might sue for a special assumpsit breach of the contract. You know, you're saying, hey, you promise in your contract, it says that if you fail to perform, you will pay me so much per day.
But would it apply for verbal contract?
Sure.
Verbal agreement?
Sure. Yeah. General assumpsit applies to a breach of implied contract, which is what your verbal contract would be.
Counterclaim?
Well, counterclaim falls in the same set of categories. You know, it's if you're doing common law, you're going to follow one of these 11
correct
items. Okay. Now, then you have to specify what your rights are. Okay, you have a right to not be disturbed, or you have a right to be paid, whatever it is that you're entitled to. This is your entitlement, and that this person is wrongful in what he's doing. Okay, he is either doing something or he's not doing something he should be doing. Okay, so either way, it's a wrongful act. And then you have the injury that you suffered, and then the conclusion, the prayer, in other words, you're asking the court to award, and you sign off on it. Yes.
The question I think she's leading to is that there was a person who borrowed and failed to pay, filed in the bankruptcy court, and misfiled the numbers. Instead of the larger number, filed a small number. Can she then cause that person in the bankruptcy to default on her number that's correct? And the
well, you sue her. You sue them.
Can't
okay.
you do it through a default just by letter? And then she defaults in 72 hours under the...
Well, if you're talking about a notice and demand, mm-hmm. and you're getting into the UCC, which I claim no knowledge of.
Well, you do cover it in your website. You do pretty good with it.
Yeah, but I don't claim to have solid knowledge in that area. Okay. The minute you say UCC, I go dumb.
I didn't say UCC. I just said default.
Sure sounded like it.
I said the word default.
Well, default in the UCC, right?
So if someone doesn't respond to your demand, then that...
you could do that, but remember, you don't have the power. Okay, so I would... You don't have the physical power to enforce your default.
Well, you take a notary, doesn't? Then you take your notary, and she creates the default.
Well, if you have that, and that's another system I haven't looked into, which is really a subset of the UCC business. Those are areas that I have yet to study. What I know is court procedure.
Correct.
Okay, how to operate a common law suit in court. This is what I know. Yes.
But if your name is already filed on the bankruptcy court, so can you still do a notice of demand?
Absolutely. You sue them. I wouldn't spend too much time on the notice of demand because you've already been named as a defendant. So
you sue in the bankruptcy court or outside?
No, what you do is you would sue wherever you're going to sue. But the bankruptcy court has to be notified that the suit is going on, because that is an adversarial action, and the purpose of bankruptcy is not to settle those lawsuits. The purpose of the bankruptcy is to distribute the assets among all the creditors. They don't get involved in disputes, and they cannot settle the accounts until all the accounts are settled. Okay, you got to get rid of these disputes. So you sue and you notify, but there's a procedure to follow. Okay, so you need to look at the bankruptcy rules and find out exactly what the method is for letting them know that you have an action going. And maybe the answer is to actually sue in the federal court and then have it removed to the state court. It might be a roundabout way, but whatever it is, the one thing I do know about bankruptcy court is that their purpose is not to settle disputes. And they cannot move forward until all disputes are settled. We did an interesting thing in bankruptcy court one time. There was a person that was declaring bankruptcy. And the first thing that happens when you do a bankruptcy, now again, I don't know much about bankruptcy, but I do know some general principles. And so she did a bankruptcy in a court of record. In the bankruptcy, the very first thing a court does when you file bankruptcy is they appoint a temporary trustee. Now it's her court appointing the trustee. Then all the creditors are notified. All the creditors have a meeting at some point, like 3 months down the road, something like that, whenever it is. And they elect from their own a trustee to represent them. Because the trustee, even though your court appointed him, the trustee works for the other side. And so, but your court has been set up. The truth is that you are the defendant, they are the plaintiff, but you started the process. But they don't know they're the plaintiff yet. And so a trustee is set up to represent them and to handle their affairs, and they dictate to the trustee what it is they want. And the amount of voting power that each creditor has is related to how big the debt is. So the biggest creditors have the most say. Okay? And so, but there's this point where you have this temporary trustee, and then you have the permanent trustee elected by the creditors, and then you get into a more normal court scenario. Okay, where the trustees representing these creditors, and actually the trustees has a little more responsibility than that. He's supposed to also be fair. Okay, also fair to the defendant as well. So it's not an adversarial action in the strictest sense. Anyway, the way bankruptcies are usually conducted, the creditors never show up. They see who the trustee is, and if they fail to show up and vote, then the new trustee is the same as the old trustee, and he now becomes a permanent trustee. Okay? So what we did on the day of the election, before the meeting, we went to the court and we filed a court order from the owner of the court, right? The person who filed bankruptcy, discharging the present trustee and appointing a new temporary trustee, one that we liked. Then we showed up at the meeting. The trustee stood up, the old trustee stood up, and we served her with these papers saying, you're no longer on the job.